You're listening to World Class from the Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies at Stanford University. We bring expertise on international affairs from Stanford's campus straight to you. I'm Michael McFaul, host of World Class and director of the Freeman Spogli Institute. As protests have erupted across the United States and the world following the killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis, people are demanding more transparency and accountability from police officers. They're also seeking bigger solutions. Our guest today has been studying these issues of human rights abuses and police violence for many, many years, not just recently, but for a long time. And she's here to discuss some of her work and how it might relate to what's going on in the United States today. Dr. Beatrice Maglione is a professor of political science and senior fellow here at the Freeman Spogli Institute. She is the founder and director of the Poverty, Violence, and Governance Lab, which works to provide solutions to lawlessness and violence. Beatrice's research focuses on the political economy of development. She recently published papers on institutionalized police brutality in Mexico and police violence in Brazil. We could not ask for a better guest to have with us today on World Class. Beatrice, thanks for joining the program.
Thank you, Mike. I'm very excited to talk with you about this research and reflect about how it matters here in the U.S. Thanks a lot for inviting me.
Great to have you here. Well, let's start with Brazil first. Just tell us a little bit about your work. Tell us how you got interested in the first place. Can you tell us about the problems of excessive violence there? And what are parallels and differences that you see between your work in Brazil and what's going on here in the United States?
I started working there, I think, at the end of 2012, and really have been working there nonstop until last summer. That was the last time I was in Brazil, and I'll tell you why I stopped going. Because things deteriorated so much that I thought I had to stop until better conditions for what we were doing sort of developed there. Wow. And so let me begin by saying that I started this research because I went with FSI master students at a trip 2 weeks in Brazil. And in one of the conversations, we were speaking with the Ministry of Security there, and they were talking about a really interesting police reform that they were doing in the favelas. That was a form of community-oriented police that was introduced. Favelas are irregular agglomerations, very poor marginalized communities. Mostly Black Brazilians live in the favelas. And the state had abandoned the favelas for years with very limited provision of services, education, access to very little justice. And the favelas, since the 1980s, became ruled by very powerful and very heavily armed drug gangs and also paramilitary groups. And the state had really ceded control of these territories. So the community-oriented policing approach that they tried to implement began because Brazil was going to have the Olympics, they were going to have the World Cup, and they didn't really want to encounter the world with really what was going on, which was very high levels of police violence in these places and very high levels of insecurity. So they created a new unit that was called the Pacifying Police Unit. And the philosophy was to bring mostly young officers that had not had prior experience with a militaristic, very violent approach of policing favelas. And I went up to one of the 8 first pacified favelas. Only 4 students went with me because it was not that safe, and it remains not safe to go up there. And I met Leonardo Nogueira, who is a police officer, who later we brought at Stanford. And I was really impressed by his philosophy, what he was doing. He was putting karate classes for kids, organic vegetable gardens, talking about developing a new relationship with the communities. And I said, wow, how do you develop this? So I decided I would learn Portuguese, begin doing work in Brazil, and then didn't stop for 12 years. I fortunately had 2 great partners, Vanessa Melo and Verien Melo, 2 Brazilian sisters. Especially Vanessa was with me all through the process. And so we began evaluating this transformation. And just to give you a little bit of a context, Brazil is today remains the most violent country in terms of police violence. Just in Rio de Janeiro, between 2003 and 2018, the police killed 16,000 people, We're talking about roughly 5 people a day being killed in the city. After the recent governor in 2018 got elected saying that the police had to shoot people in the head, police killings increased by more than 20%. And just as a way of comparison, in the US, on average, more or less, we have 1,000 people killed. It is as though, I mean, if you compare, it's like if we had in the US 36,000 deaths a year. That's the equivalent to what goes on in Rio. And obviously, I mean, not all of it is really unjustified killings. So we say a lot of the violence happens in armed confrontations between police and heavily armed criminal groups that were the, you know, the rulers of these places, mostly devoted to drug trafficking. Also, there is a great deal of excessive use of force, extrajudicial killings, evidence that police kill people, even criminals, on the back, in the head. And unfortunately, a lot of cases where the community gets injured, dies in the crossfire, police committing a lot of atrocities to community members as well. So what happens in the US, it's really, I hate to say in that way, but really, in Brazil, there is no comparison in the level of violence, but the parallels are really striking in the sense that it targets mostly Black Brazilians. Right. And so in that sense, there is some similarities in that the sort of country's history with racial segregation and slavery and how these institutions in Brazil, at least, really clearly evolved to preserve sort of the privileges of a very rich white elite. So that's where the parallels are. But I think that we have to really keep in mind that the differences are really striking in the level of violence. Yes.
Right. And regarding your findings, do you have a sense of what works and what doesn't regarding the control of police brutality in Brazil?
Mike, I think we have really, for the 12 years that we worked there, we made a lot of really good progress in evaluating the progress that was being made and also what was making a difference and then what didn't work. So let me just give you a very short list. So militaristic policing approaches are incredibly violent. And so our research does demonstrate that the community-oriented policing approach, and this is with a very systematic and very thorough statistical work that tried to match favelas that were not intervened with this approach versus favelas that were intervened, controlled by different forms of criminal organizations. Right. We find a 60% reduction by the year of 2013. So this program started in 2008. By 2013, there was a 60% reduction in the number of police killings. And then unfortunately, things started to deteriorate. And if you see the data, then violence and police killings started to escalate again. But despite that, still today, it made a difference of 40% less lethality. Unfortunately, the current governor and Bolsonaro also, it's very right-wing politicians. He literally came to power, got himself inside a helicopter with a machine gun. That's the governor. And shooting from the helicopter to favela people and the favelas. I mean, this is the type of violence we're talking about. So as I mentioned, with politicians endorsing this violence, all the changes were reversed of the community-oriented policing approach. Then second thing we were doing, this is a very large corporation, 40,000 police officers, and there is a very serious problems for supervisors and top-level officials to monitor what goes on in the streets. So right. We were developing a very difficult thing to do methodology to track police officers. So in part, thanks to what we did and also other people in Rio, we were able to track the 20 most violent people, the police. They took them out from the streets. And then we began helping with a major retraining program that was going to target the 5 battalions that generate the most killings. Oh, sorry about my dog.
We're glad to have your dog on our podcast.
It's the problem is they're barking. It's not, so we were evaluating this retraining program. There was commitment on the part of top level police to say this has to stop. And again, with the election of Bolsonaro and Wilson things collapsed. So that's where I decided conditions were not good for us to continue working. Maybe someday things would improve and then we would, commitment to these policies would come back. And then we also did a randomized evaluation, putting cameras on police officers. We spent a year doing that study. Taser actually donated the cameras for us.
I remember that, yes.
And the study was really fascinating in understanding the challenges to implement this type of measures in places with such institutional fragility. The good news is that we find a 40% reduction in the number of incidences where police shoot their guns. I just have to say the average number of guns they shoot when they go to the street, it's 30 guns per event. So we're talking about really serious confrontations. There was a 40% reduction, and there was also a very drastic reduction in the number of stop and searches, violent encounters with residents, and very sharp reduction on aggressions of residents towards the police.
Uh-huh.
But the paradox of our study was that the police refused to turn the cameras on most of the time.
Uh-huh.
So it was only having the cameras and knowing that there was this intention to monitor them that changed the behavior. But the problem is, like, if you are going to make this a solution, you have to solve the problem of compliance. As right. we have seen here in the US, often police don't film when they don't want to film or hide right. the videos when they're hiding. So who is going to be forcing them to turn the cameras on and monitoring the officers who are monitoring the frontline officers, no? So just to abstract from this series of measures, demilitarization of the police, community-oriented policing, better monitoring, putting cameras. I tell you, Mike, that I don't think there is going to be a solution if society at large doesn't demand a change in the way police behave. In Brazil, unfortunately, the middle class and the high class are very tolerant. There is a very, to police violence, there is a phrase in Brazil that is called bandido bom ou bandido morto. That means a good criminal is a dead criminal.
Wow. And
50% of Brazilians support that phrase, which means that they are really endorsing police vigilantism. And as we see then, politicians like Bolsonaro and then Wilson get elected and empowered with this polarization. So
right.
my take on this is that you are never going to solve the problem if you don't look beyond the police. Obviously, working inside the police is necessary, but it's really about social acceptability. And
right.
then what politicians really, sort of whether politicians really want to control this or not. What is happening here in the US is very encouraging, I think.
Right. Well, first of all, those are some fantastic findings. And we'll make sure that we'll post on our, when we circulate this conversation, links that people can follow up and read that research. But I think what you just said is very important, that you cannot divorce the problem of police violence from societal attitudes. And very much sounds like a conversation we need to have more here in our country and are starting to. Before we pivot to America, though, tell us a little bit about your work in Mexico on torture, just so we get to that before ending on the United States.
Yeah, so I tend to work on dark.
Yes.
And, yes,
I'm glad you brought it up. Thank you for that work.
Obsession with this abuse of power. But as you know, Mike, I'm a lawyer by training. So I yes. had some experience in criminal law before becoming a graduate student in political science. And I always right. had this sort of obsession with the criminal justice system in Mexico and what I observed as students. So when I began working on Brazil, I started to obviously think about Mexico. And the problem in Mexico is really not, I mean, there are many problems, but what is really the most terrible brutality that police perform relates to judicial torture and how, I mean, we come from an authoritarian regime. Mexico transitioned to democracy in 2000. But these institutions that were seriously abusive of rights persisted. And police and prosecutors didn't really invest in capacity to investigate crimes. So
right.
with the really increasing crime rates that we observed after democratization, unfortunately, these persistent old practices just became increasingly more abusive. So in this paper that I published with my student, Luis Rodriguez, we document a really very large prevalence of judicial torture that is used as a method of criminal investigation because they don't know how to investigate. Right. And then judges in Mexico, for the most part, have been very tolerant with this behavior. So there was a really interesting and important effort on the part of Mexico to reform the entire system. And this reform happened in all the states. They had to adopt completely new criminal justice procedures that were, there was a lot of emphasis on monitoring what was going on at the face of the investigation by judges.
Okay.
There is a judge that now controls that phase. So he's really taking a lot of power out of police and prosecutors to just do whatever they did before. And we demonstrate that that reform, which was a constitutional reform that implied massive investment in retraining investigators, retraining judges, retraining police, really had a big impact in reducing torture in Mexico. Obviously, abuses remain and it's still very high levels, but I think the case highlights that with a major reform of the criminal justice system, things can change, even those deep, very deeply authoritarian practices.
Well, that's some optimistic news at a time when we haven't had much. And I should have mentioned, by the way, at the outset, Beatriz is originally from Mexico, just for our listeners, so that you know that. Maybe my last question, and it's a big, hard one, so take it in any direction you want. What do these policing practices, what you learned in Mexico, and even what you're observing now here in the United States, tell us about definitions of democracy in these different countries? What's the right conceptual way to think about it? You mentioned Mexico made a transition from authoritarian rule. We have made a transition or started here in the United States, depending on how you think about it. But obviously, things we're witnessing here and things you've witnessed in Mexico and Brazil are just radical violations of human rights. How do you think about it in terms of democracy abstractly? So, or not abstractly, even very practically?
This is really very important question. And I think we are precisely having this reflection now at a very large scale, I think, today in the US. But what is happening here, it's already influencing, for example, Brazil today. Interestingly, in Brazil, because of the myth of lack of racial differences, that was a myth that was created there. There was never a movement for Black Lives Matter as there is, and that recognition that there is something about racism and injustice that is really deeply connected to what we are observing. So democracy is incredibly weak and deficient if you cannot offer protections for populations that are vulnerable. In the case of the US, it's mostly Black Americans, but also Brown and Black Americans that really don't have access to fundamental rights. What we observe in Brazil and Mexico is even more extreme because it reaches so many aspects of society in which people don't have a right to security. So we are living in a very sort of security deprived communities that don't have a right to life, to property, to walk freely in the streets without being harmed by someone, either from the state or from criminal groups. So I think it does tell a lot about the weakness of our democracy. And it raises the question of why is it? And I am right now thinking a lot about that. I think that what I mentioned in Brazil, there is significant endorsement on the part of a big sector of society for some of these policies. In Mexico, for example, we show in our paper that when the military were sent to the streets, this torture increased. But there is also, there was a big support for the military to go in the streets because people feel afraid.
Right.
And so they want really tough hand approaches. And so they endorse policies that create a lot of harm and to these fundamental rights. So we really have to understand more, I think, as political scientists, those connections between politics, accountability, and what we observed in the criminal justice system, because it's not completely disconnected. So I wouldn't be able to say that about the US, but in Mexico, there was a big endorsement in a way on tough hand approaches.
Right.
And in Brazil, we see that, no? often it is also the case that people just don't know the misery that these policies create and just are very ignorant about this. But we need to explore more about how to really expand citizenship to everyone, and especially in this case, it's the poor and racial minorities. Just speculation, Mike, yes.
Well, you just said, I think, a very important thing, though. We need to learn more. We need to research more. And, you know, the work that you do in your lab, Havgab, you know, when people talk about, well, what does the academy have to do with the real world? I think it's really an excellent example where research, social science research, can actually uncover things that can be useful for policy. So I just find it inspirational, Beatrice. Thank you for taking some time to talk about it here. And tragically, I think we're going to have you back, because this is not an issue that's going away either in Brazil or Mexico or the United States. So we hope that we can call on you again.
Thank you so much, Mike. I appreciate it so much. I really feel also excited that my work has, you know, in a way, so much to offer for what is going on in the US. And I also am eager to learn about how to fix things here as well. So,
right.
So it's just a good coincidence
at the
moment, unfortunately, for very sad events.
Yes. Sad events, but we're lucky to have people like you here at Stanford. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Mike.
You've been listening to World Class from the Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies at Stanford University. If you like what you're hearing, please review us on Apple Podcasts. We'd love to know your thoughts. And be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Overcast, or wherever you're listening to stay up to date on what's happening in the world and why.